Dave, walking beside them in silent acclaim. Broud's position, in front of the victorious men, announced his kill. Even Ayla, who couldn't understand what was going on, was caught up in the excitement that hung palpably in the air.
Chapter 6. The son of your mate did well, Brunn. It was a good, clean kill, Zaug said as the hunters eased the great beast down in front of the cave. You have a new hunter to be proud of.
He showed courage and a strong arm, Brunn gestured.
He laid his hand on the young man's shoulder, his eyes glowing with pride. Broud basked in the warm praise. Zaug and Dorv examined the mighty young bull with admiration tinged with nostalgia for the excitement of the chase and the thrill of success, forgetting the dangers and disappointments that were part of the arduous adventure of hunting big game. No longer able to hunt with the younger men, but not wanting to be left out, the two old men had spent the morning scouting the wooded hillsides for smaller prey.
I see you and Dorv put your slings to good use. I could smell the meat cooking halfway up the hill, Brunn continued. When we get settled in the new cave, we'll have to find a place to practice. The clan would benefit if all the hunters had your skill with the sling, Zaug, and it won't be long before Vorn will need to be trained.
The leader was aware of the contribution the older men still made to the sustenance of the clan and wanted them to know it. The hunters were not always successful. More than once, meat was supplied by the efforts of the older men, and during the heavy snows of winter, occasional fresh meat was often more easily brought down with a sling. It provided a welcome change from their winter diet of dried preserved meat, especially later in the season when the frozen supplies from late fall hunts ran out.
Nothing like the young bison there, but we got a few rabbits and a fat beaver. The food is ready. We've just been waiting for you, Zaug motioned. I did notice a level clearing not far away that might make a good practice field.
Zaug, who had lived with Grad since the death of his mate, had worked to improve his skill with the sling after he retired from the ranks of Brunn's hunters. It and the bola were the most difficult weapons for the men of the clan to master. Though their muscular, heavy-boned, and slightly bowed arms were tremendously powerful, they could perform functions as delicate and precise as napping flint. The development of their arm joints, particularly the way muscles and tendons were attached to bones, gave them precise manual dexterity coupled with unbelievable strength. But there was a penalty. That same joint development restricted arm movement. They could not make a full, free-swinging arc, which limited their ability to hurl objects. Not fine control, but leverage was the price they paid for strength. Their spear was not a javelin thrown across a distance, but rather a lance thrust at close range with great force. Training with spear or club was little more than developing powerful muscles, but learning to use a sling or a bola took years of practice and concentration. The sling, a strip of flexible leather held together at both ends and whirled around the head to gain momentum before flinging the round pebble held in the bulging cup at the middle, took great effort. And Zaug was proud of his ability to sling a stone accurately. He was equally proud that Brunn called upon him to train young hunters in the use of that weapon. While Zaug and Dorv ranged the hillsides hunting with slings, the women had foraged over the same terrain, and the tantalizing aroma of cooking food whetted the appetites of the hunters. It made them realize that hunting was hungry work. They did not have long to wait. The men relaxed after the meal, replete with satisfaction, retelling the incidents of the exciting hunt for their own pleasure and the benefit of Zaug and Dorv. Broud, glowing with his new status and the hearty congratulations of his new peers, noticed Born looking at him with unabashed admiration. Until that morning, Broud and Born had been equals, and Born had been his only male companion among the children of the clan since Guv had become a man. Broud remembered hanging around hunters just returned from the hunt, as Born was doing. No more would he have to stand on the fringes, ignored by the men, as he eagerly watched them tell their stories. No more would he be subject to the commands of his mother and the other women calling him away to help with the chores. He was a hunter now, a man. His manhood status lacked only the final ceremony, and that would be part of the cave ceremony, which would make it especially memorable and lucky. When that happened, he would be the lowest-ranked male, but it mattered little to him. It would change. His place was foreordained. He was the son of the maid of the leader. Someday the mantle of leadership would fall to him. Vorn had been a pest sometimes, but now Broud could afford to be magnanimous. He walked over to the 4-year-old boy, not unaware that Born's eyes lit up with eager anticipation when he saw the new hunter approaching. Vorn, I think you're old enough. Groud motioned a little pompously, trying to seem more manly. I will make a spear for you. It's time you began training to be a hunter. Vorn squirmed with delight, pure adulation shining out of his eyes as he looked up at the young man who so recently gained the coveted status of hunter. Yes, he nodded in vigorous agreement. I'm old enough, Groud, the youngster motioned shyly. He gestured toward the stout staff with a dark bloodstained point. Could I touch it? Groud laid the point of his spear on the ground in front of the boy. Vorn reached out a tentative finger and touched the dried blood of the huge bison that now lay on the ground in front of the cave. Were you scared, Groud? He asked.
Brunn says all hunters are nervous on their first hunt, Groud replied, not wanting to admit his fears.
Vorn, there you are. I should have guessed. You're supposed to be helping Olga collect wood,
Aga said, seeing her son who had slipped away from the women and children. Vorn straggled after his mother, glancing back over his shoulder at his new idol. Brunn had been watching the son of his mate with approval. It is the sign of a good leader, he thought, not to forget the boy just because he is still a child. Someday Vorn will be a hunter, and when Groud is leader, Vorn will remember a kindness shown to him as a child. Groud watched Vorn trail behind his mother, dragging his feet. Just the day before, Abra had come for him to help with the chores, he remembered. He glanced at the women digging a pit and had an urge to sneak away so his mother wouldn't see him. But then he noticed Olga looking in his direction. My mother can't tell me what to do anymore. I'm not a child. I'm a man. She has to obey me now, Groud thought, puffing up his chest a little. She does, doesn't she? And Olga is watching.
Abra, bring me a drink of water,
he commanded imperiously, swaggering toward the women. He half expected his mother to tell him to get wood. Technically, he wouldn't be a man until after his manhood ceremony. Abra looked up at him, and her eyes filled with pride. That was her baby boy who had discharged his mission so effectively, her son who had reached the exalted status of manhood. She jumped up, went to the pool near the cave, and returned quickly with water, glancing haughtily at the other women as if to say, "Look at my son. Isn't he a fine man? Isn't he a brave hunter?" His mother's alacrity and her look of pride eased his defensiveness and disposed him to favor her with a grunt of acknowledgment. Abra's response pleased him almost as much as the demurely bowed head of Olga and the look of adoration he noticed as her eyes followed him when he turned to leave. Olga had been grief-stricken over the death of her mother, following so soon after the death of her mother's mate. As the only child of the pair, even though she was a girl, she had been dearly loved by both. Brunn's mate was kind to her when she went to live with the leader's family, sitting with them when she ate, and walking behind Abra while they were searching for a cave. But Brunn frightened her. He was more stern than her mother's mate had been. His responsibility lay heavily on his shoulders. Abra's main concern was for Brunn, and no one had much time for the orphaned girl while they were traveling. But Groud had seen her sitting alone, staring dejectedly into the fire one evening. Olga was overwhelmed with gratitude when the proud boy, almost a man, who had seldom paid attention to her before, sat down beside her and put an arm around her shoulder as she softly keened her grief. From that moment on, Olga lived with one desire. When she became a woman, she wanted to be given to Groud as his mate. The late afternoon sun was warm in the motionless air. Not the hint of a breeze stirred the least leaf. The expectant hush was disturbed only by the drone of flies taking their turn at the remains of the repast and the sounds of the women digging a roasting pit. Ayla was sitting beside Issa as the medicine woman searched in her outer skin pouch for the red bag. The child had been tagging behind her all day, but now there were certain rituals Issa had to perform with Mogur in preparation for the important role she had to play in the cave ceremony the next day, now that they were certain there would be one. She led the tow-headed girl toward the group of women excavating a deep hole not far from the cave mouth. It would be lined with rocks, with a large fire built inside that would burn all night. In the morning, the skinned and quartered bison, wrapped in leaves, would be lowered into the pit, covered with more leaves and a layer of soil, and left to cook in the stone oven until late afternoon. The excavation was a slow and tedious process. Pointed digging sticks were used to break up the soil that was scooped out by throwing handfuls on a leather cloak, which was hauled up out of the pit and dumped. But once the pit was dug, it could be used many times, only requiring an occasional cleaning out of ashes. While the women dug, Olga and Vorn, under the watchful eye of Uka's unmated daughter Ovra, were collecting wood and bringing stones up from the stream. As Issa approached holding the child's hand, the women stopped. I must see Mogur, Issa said with a gesture. Then she gave Ayla a little shove toward the group. Ayla started to follow Issa as she turned to go, but the woman shook her head and pushed her back toward the women, then hurriedly left. It was Ayla's first contact with anyone in the clan besides Issa and Kreb, and she felt lost and shy without Issa's comforting presence. She stood rooted to the spot, nervously staring at her feet, glancing up apprehensively now and then. Against all propriety, everyone stared at the thin, long-legged girl with the peculiar flat face and bulging forehead. They had all been curious about the child, but this was their first opportunity to get a close look at her. Abra finally broke the spell. She can gather wood, the leader's mate indicated with an unspoken motion to Ovra, then started digging again. The young woman walked toward a patch of trees and fallen logs. Olga and Vorn could hardly tear themselves away. Ovra beckoned to the two children impatiently, then beckoned to Ayla as well. The girl thought she understood the gesture, but she wasn't sure what was expected of her. Ovra motioned again, then turned and headed for the trees. The two clan members who were closest to Ayla's age reluctantly trailed after Ovra. The girl watched them go, then took a few hesitant steps after them. When she reached the trees, Ayla stood around for a while, watching Olga and Vorn pick up dried branches, while Ovra hacked away at a good-sized fallen log with her stone hand axe. Olga, returning from depositing a load of wood near the pit, started dragging toward the woodpile a section of the log Ovra had detached. Ayla saw her struggling and walked over to help. She bent over to pick up the opposite end of the log, and as they both stood up, she looked into Olga's dark eyes. They stopped and stared at each other for a moment. The two girls were so different, yet so provocatively similar. Sprung from the same ancient seed, the progeny of their common ancestor took alternate routes, both leading to a richly developed, if dissimilar, intelligence. Both sapient, for a time both dominant, the gulf that separated them was not great, but the subtle differences created a vastly different destiny. With each holding an end of the log, Ayla and Olga carried it to the pile of wood. As they walked back side by side, the women stopped their work again and watched them go. The two girls were near the same height, though the taller was nearly twice the age of the other. One was slender, straight-limbed, fair-haired. The other stocky, bow-legged, darker. The women compared them, but the young girls, as with children everywhere, soon forgot their differences. Sharing made the task easier, and before the day was through, they found ways to communicate and to add an element of play into the chore. That evening, they sought each other out and sat together while they ate, enjoying the pleasure of company closer to their own size. Issa was happy to see that Olga was accepting Ayla and waited until dark before she went to get the child for bed. They stared after each other as they parted. Then Olga turned away and walked to her fur beside Abra. The women and men still slept separately. Mogur's prohibition would not be lifted until they moved into the cave. Issa's eyes were open with a first glimmer of early light. She lay still, listening to the melodious cacophony of birds chirping, warbling, twittering and trilling in greeting to the new day. Soon, she was thinking, she would open her eyes to stone walls. She didn't mind sleeping outside as long as the weather was pleasant, but she looked forward to the security of walls. Her thoughts made her remember everything she had to do that day, and thinking about the cave ceremony with growing excitement, she quietly got up. Kreb was already awake. She wondered if he had slept at all. He was still sitting in the same place she left him the night before, staring in contemplative silence at the fire. She started heating water, and by the time she brought him his morning tea of mint, alfalfa, and nettle leaves, Ayla was up and sitting beside the crippled man. Issa brought the child a breakfast of leftovers from the previous evening's meal. The men and women would not eat that day until the ritual feast. By late afternoon, delicious smells were drifting away from the several fires where food was cooking and pervading the area near the cave. Utensils and other cooking paraphernalia that had been salvaged from their former cave and carried in the bundles by the women had been unpacked. Finely made, tightly woven waterproof baskets of subtle texture and design created by slight alterations in weaving were used to dip water from the pool and as cooking pots and containers. Wooden bowls were used in similar ways. Rib bones were stirrers. Large flat pelvic bones were plates and platters along with thin sections of logs. Jaw and head bones were ladles, cups, and bowls. Birch bark glued together with balsam gum, some reinforced with a well-placed knot of sinew, were folded into shapes for many uses. In an animal hide hung from a thong-lashed frame set over a fire, a savory broth bubbled.
Careful watch was kept to make sure the liquid didn't boil down too far. As long as the level of boiling broth was above the level reached by the flames, it kept the temperature of the skin pot too low to burn. Ayla watched Uka stir up chunks of the meat and bone from the neck of the bison that were cooking with wild onion, salty coltsfoot, and other herbs. Uka tasted it, then added peeled thistle stalks, mushrooms, lily buds and roots, watercress, milkweed buds, small immature yams, cranberries carried from the other cave, and wilted flowers from the previous day's growth of daylilies for thickening. The hard, fibrous old roots of cattails had been crushed and the fibers separated and removed. Dried blueberries they had carried with them and parched ground grains were added to the resulting starch that settled in the bottom of the baskets of cold water. Lumps of the flat, dark, unleavened bread were cooking on hot stones near the fire. Pigweed greens, lamb's quarter, young clover, and dandelion leaves seasoned with coltsfoot were cooking in another pot, and a sauce of dried, tart apples mixed with wild rose petals and a lucky find of honey steamed near another fire. Isa had been especially pleased when she saw Zaug returning from a trip to the steppes with a clutch of ptarmigan. The low-flying, heavy birds, easily brought down with stones from the marksman's sling, were Kreb's favorite. Stuffed with herbs and edible greens that nested their own whole eggs, and wrapped in wild grape leaves, the savory fowl were cooking in a smaller stone-lined pit. Hares and giant hamsters, skinned and skewered, were roasting over hot coals, and mounds of tiny, fresh wild strawberries glistened bright red in the sun. It was a feast worthy of the occasion. Ayla wasn't sure she could wait. She'd been wandering aimlessly around the fringes of the cooking area all day. Both Isa and Kreb were off somewhere most of the time, and when Isa was around, she was busy. Oga, too, was busily working with the women preparing the feast, and no one had time or inclination to bother with the girl. After a few gruff words and not-so-gentle nudges from the harried women, she tried to stay out of the way. As the long shadows of the late afternoon sun lay across the red soil that fronted the cave, a hush of anticipation descended on the clan. Everyone gathered around the large pit in which the haunches of bison were cooking. Abra and Uka began removing the warm soil from the top. They pulled back limp, scorched leaves and exposed the sacrificial beast in a cloud of mouth-watering steam. So tender, it almost fell from the bones, the meat was carefully raised. To Abra, as the leader's mate, fell the duty of carving and serving, and her pride was obvious when she gave the first piece to her son. Proud evidenced no false modesty as he stepped forward to receive his due. After all the men were served, the women received their share, and then the children. Ayla was last, but there was more than enough for everyone, with leftovers to spare. The next hush that descended was the result of the hungry clan busily devouring the meal. It was a leisurely feast, with one person or another going back to pick at a bit more bison or a second helping of a favorite dish. The women had worked hard. But their reward was not only the comments from the satisfied clan. They would not have to cook again for a few days. They all rested afterward, getting ready for a long evening. When the lengthening shadows merged into the dull gray half-light of approaching darkness, the mood of the lazy afternoon subtly altered, became charged with expectation. At a glance from Brunn, the women quickly cleared away the remains of the feast and took up places around an unlit fireplace at the mouth of the cave. The random look of the group belied the formality of their positions. The women stood in relation to each other according to their status. The men who gathered on the other side fell into a pattern according to their hierarchical place within the clan, but Mogur was not in sight. Brunn, closest to the front, signaled Grad, who stepped forward with slow dignity, and from his aurochs horn produced a glowing coal. It was the most important in the long line of coals that began with the fire lighted in the debris of the old cave. A continuation of that fire symbolized the continuation of the life of the clan. Lighting this fire at the entrance would lay claim to the cave, establish it as their place of residence. Controlled fire was a device of man, essential to life in a cold climate. Even smoke had beneficial properties. The smell alone evoked a feeling of safety and home. The smoke from the cave fire, filtering up through the cavern to the high vaulted ceiling, would find its way out through cracks and on drafts through the opening. It would take away with it any unseen forces that might be inimical to them, purge the cave, and permeate it with their essence,
the essence of human. Lighting the fire was sufficient ritual to purify and lay claim to the cave, but certain other rituals were performed so often along with it, they were almost considered a part of the cave ceremony. One was familiarizing the spirits of their protective totems with their new home, usually done in private by Mogur with an audience of men only. Women were allowed their own celebration, which gave Issa reason to make a special drink for the men. The successful hunt had already shown that their totems approved of the site, and the feast confirmed their intention to make it a permanent home, though the clan might be gone for extended periods at certain times. Totemic spirits traveled too, but as long as members of the clan had their amulets, their totems could track them from the cave and come when they were needed. Since the spirits would be present at the cave ceremony anyway, other ceremonies could be included, and often were. Any ceremony was enhanced by association with the establishment of a new home, and in turn added to the clan's territorial bond. Though each kind of ceremony had its own traditional ritual which never changed, ceremonial occasions had different characters depending upon which rituals were conducted. Mogur, usually in consultation with Brun, decided how the various parts would be put together to form the total celebration. But it was an organic thing that depended on how they felt. This one would include Braud's manhood ceremony and one to name the totems of certain youngsters, since that needed to be done, and they had a desire to please the spirits. Time was not an important factor. It would take as long as it took. But had they been harassed or in danger, simply lighting a fire would have made the cave theirs. With gravity befitting the importance of the task, Grad kneeled down, put the glowing ember on the dry tinder, and began to blow. The clan leaned forward anxiously and expelled their breath in one communal sigh as flaming tongues licked the dry sticks in their first fatal taste. The fire took hold, and suddenly, appearing from nowhere, a frightful figure was seen standing so close to the bonfire, its roaring flames seemed to envelop him in their midst. It had a bright red face, surmounted by an eerie white skull that appeared to hang within the fire itself, unscathed by the leaping tendrils of lambent energy. Ayla didn't see the fiery apparition at first, and gasped when she caught sight of it. She felt Issa squeeze her hand in reassurance. The child felt the vibrations of the dull thud of spear butts pounding the ground, and jumped back when the newest hunter leaped to the area in front of the flames just as Dorf beat a sharp tattoo in rhythmic counterpoint on a large wooden bowl-shaped instrument turned face down against a log. Braud crouched down and looked far into the distance, his hand shading his eyes from a non-existent sun, as other hunters leaped up to join him in a reenactment of the bison hunt. So evocative was their skill at pantomime, polished by generations of communicating by gesture and signal, the intense emotion of the hunt was recreated. Even the 5-year-old stranger was captivated by the impact of the drama. The women of the clan, perceptive of the fine nuances, were transported to the hot, dusty plains. They could feel the thundering hooves vibrating the earth, taste the choking dust, share the exultation of the kill. It was a rare privilege for them to be allowed this glimpse into the sacrosanct life of the hunters. From the first, Braud took command of the dance. It had been his kill, and it was his night. He could sense the empathetic emotions, feel the women quivering with fear, and he responded with more passionately intense dramatics. Braud was a consummate actor, and never more in his element than when he was the center of attention. He played on the emotions of his audience, and the ecstatic shudder that passed through the women as he replayed his final thrust had an erotic quality. Mogur, watching from behind the fire, was no less impressed. He often saw the men talk of hunting, but only during these infrequent ceremonies was he able to share the experience in anything close to its full range of excitement. The lad did well, the magician thought, moving around to the front of the fire. He earned his totem mark. Perhaps he deserves to swagger a little. The young man's final lunge brought him directly in front of the powerful man of magic as the dull thudding rhythm and the excited staccato counterpoint ended with a flourish. The old magician and the young hunter stood facing each other. Mogur knew how to play his role, too. The master of timing waited, letting the excitement of the hunt dance subside and a sense of expectancy rise. His hulking, lopsided figure, cloaked in a heavy bearskin, was silhouetted against the blazing fire. His ochre-reddened face was shadowed by his own frame, masking his features to an indefinable blur with the baleful, asymmetrical eye of a supernatural daemon. The stillness of the night was disturbed only by the crackling fire, a soft wind soughing through the trees, and the whooping cackle of a hyena in the distance. Thraud was panting, and his eyes glittered, partly from the exertion of the dance, partly from the excitement and his pride, but more from a growing, disquieting fear. He knew what came next, and the longer it took, the more he fought to control a chill that wanted to be a tremble. It was time for Mogur to carve his totem mark into his flesh. He hadn't let himself think about it, but now that the time had come, Thraud found himself dreading more than the pain. The magician projected an aura that filled the young man with a much greater fear. He was treading on the threshold of the spirit world, the place that encompassed beings far more terrifying than gigantic bison. For all their size and strength, bison were at least solid, substantial creatures of the physical world, creatures that a man could come to grips with. But the invisible, yet far more powerful forces that could make the very earth shake were another matter entirely. Thraud was not the only one present who stifled a shudder as thoughts of the recently experienced earthquake suddenly imploded on their minds. Only holy men, Mogurs, dared to face that insubstantial plane, and the superstitious young man wished this greatest of all Mogurs would hurry and get it over with. As though in answer to Braud's silent plea, the magician lifted his arm and stared up at the crescent moon. Then, with smooth-flowing motions, he began an impassioned appeal. But his audience was not the mesmerized watching clan. His eloquence was directed to the ethereal, though no less real, world of the spirits, and his motions were eloquent. Using every subtle trick of posture, every nuance of gesture, the one-armed man had overcome his handicap to his own language. He was more expressive with his single arm than most men were with two. By the time he was through, the clan knew they were surrounded by the essence of their protective totems and a host of other unknown spirits, and Braud's chill became a shiver. Then quickly, with a suddenness that brought a gasp to a few lips, the magician whipped out a sharp stone knife from a fold of his wrap and held it high over his head. He brought the sharp tool down swiftly, plunging it toward Braud's chest. In a movement that was under absolute control, Mogur stopped short of fatal penetration. Instead, with quick strokes, he carved two lines into the young man's flesh. Both curved in the same direction and joined in a point like the great curved horn of a rhinoceros. Thraud closed his eyes, but didn't flinch as the knife pierced his skin. Blood welled to the surface and overflowed, spilling down his chest in red rivulets. Guv appeared at the magician's side, holding a bowl of salve made from the rendered fat of the bison, mixed with antiseptic ashes from the wood of an ash tree. Mogur smeared the black grease into the wound, stopping the flowing blood and assuring that a black scar would form. The mark announced to all who saw him that Thraud was a man. A man forever under the protection of the spirit of the formidable, unpredictable, woolly rhinoceros. The young man returned to his place, acutely conscious of the attention focused on him and thoroughly enjoying it, now that the worst was over. He was sure his bravery and hunting skill, his evocative performance during the dance, his unflinching acceptance of his totem mark, would be the subject of animated talk of both men and women for a long time. He thought it might become a legend. A story repeated many times during the long cold winters that confined the clan to the cave, and retold at clan gatherings. If it wasn't for me, this cave wouldn't be ours, he said to himself. If I hadn't killed the bison, we wouldn't be having a ceremony. We'd still be looking for a cave. Thraud had begun to feel the new cave and the whole eventful occasion were entirely due to him. Ayla watched the ritual with fear and fascination. Unable to suppress a shudder as the fearsome, hulking man stabbed Thraud and drew blood. She hung back as Issa led her toward the frightening, bear-cloaked magician, wondering what he would do to her. Aga, with Ona in her arms, and Ika, carrying Borg, were also approaching Mogur. Ayla was glad when both women lined up in front of Issa and herself. Guv now held a tightly woven basket, dyed red from the many times it had been used to hold the sacred red ochre, ground to a fine powder, and heated together with animal fat to make a richly colored paste.
This is the end of disc number 3. Please insert disc number 4. This is disc number 4.
Guv now held a tightly woven basket, dyed red from the many times it had been used to hold the sacred red ochre, ground to a fine powder, and heated together with animal fat to make a richly colored paste. Mogur looked over the heads of the women standing in front of him at the sliver of moon overhead. He made gestures in the unspoken formal language, asking the spirits to gather close and observe the youngsters whose protective totems were to be revealed. Then, dipping a finger into the red paste, he drew a spiral on the hip of the male child, like the corkscrew tail of the wild pig. A low, gruff murmur rose from the clan, as they made gestures commenting on the appropriateness of the totem. "Spirit of the boar, the boy, Borg, is delivered into your protection," the magician's hand signal stated as he slipped a small pouch attached to a thong over the baby's head. Ika bowed her head in acquiescence, and the motion carried overtones that she was pleased. It was a strong, respectable spirit, and she felt the inherent rightness of the totem for her son. Then she stepped aside. The magician called upon the spirits again, and reaching into the red basket held by Guv, he drew a circle on Ona's arm with the paste. "Spirit of Owl," his gestures proclaimed, "the girl, Ona, is delivered into your protection." Then Mogur put the amulet her mother had made around the infant's neck. Once more there was an undercurrent of grunts as hands flashed in comment on the strong totem that protected the girl. Aga was happy. Her daughter was well protected, and it meant the man she mated could not have a weak totem. She only hoped it wouldn't make it too difficult for her to have children. The group strained forward with interest as Aga moved aside, and Issa reached down to lift Ayla in her arms. The girl was no longer frightened. She realized, now that she was closer, that the imposing figure with the red-stained face was none other than Kreb. There was a glow of warmth in his eye when he looked at her. To the clan's surprise, the magician's gestures were different when he called upon the spirits to attend this ritual. They were the gestures he used when he named a newborn child 7 days after its birth. The strange girl was not only going to have her totem revealed, she was going to be adopted by the clan. Dipping his finger into the paste, Mogur drew a line from the middle of her forehead, the place on people of the clan where the bony ridges overhanging their eyes met, to the tip of her small nose. "The child's name is Ayla," he said, pronouncing her name slowly and carefully, so both the clan and the spirits would understand. Issa turned to face the watching people. Ayla's adoption was as much a surprise to her as it was to the rest, and the girl could feel her rapidly beating heart. "This must mean she is my daughter, my first child," she thought. "Only a mother holds the infant when it is named and recognized as a member of the clan. Has it been 7 days since I found her? I'm not sure. I'll have to ask Kreb, but I think it has. She must be my daughter. Who else can be her mother now?" Each person filed past Issa, holding the 5-year-old girl in her arms like a baby, and each repeated her name with varying degrees of accuracy. Then Issa turned back to face the magician. He looked up and called upon the spirits to gather once more. The clan waited expectantly. Mogur was aware of their eager attention and used it to his advantage. With slow, deliberate movements, drawing out the moment to sustain the suspense, he scooped out a bit of the oily red paste and then painted one line directly over one of the healing claw marks on Ayla's leg. What can that mean? What totem is that? The watching clan was mystified. The holy man dipped into the red basket again and painted a second line over the next mark. The girl felt Issa begin to shake. None of the others moved, not a breath could be heard. With the third line, Brunn, with an angry scowl, tried to catch Mogur's eye, but the magician evaded the look. When the fourth line was drawn, the clan knew, but they did not want to believe. It was, after all, the wrong leg. Mogur turned his head and looked straight at Brunn as he made the final gesture. "Spirit of Cave Lion, the girl, Ayla, is delivered into your protection." The formalized movement removed the last shred of doubt. As Mogur put the amulet around her neck, hands flew in shocked surprise. Could it really be true? Could a girl's totem be one of the strongest of male totems? The cave lion? Kreb's stare into the angry eyes of his brother was firm and uncompromising. For a moment, they were locked in a silent battle of wills, but Mogur knew that the logic of a cave lion totem for the girl was implacable, no matter how illogical it seemed for a female to have the protection of so powerful a spirit. Mogur had only emphasized what the cave lion himself had done. Brunn had never questioned the revelations of his crippled brother before, but for some reason he felt tricked by the magician. He didn't like it, but he had to admit he had never seen a totem so obviously corroborated. He was the first to look away, but he wasn't happy. The idea of taking the strange child into the clan had been difficult enough, but this totem of hers was too much. It was irregular, unconventional. Brun didn't like anomalies in his well-ordered clan. He clamped his jaw shut with determination. There would be no further deviations. If the girl was to be a member of his clan, she would conform, cave lion or no cave lion. Issa was stunned. Still holding the child in her arms, she lowered her head in acceptance. If Mogur decreed it, it must be so. She knew Ayla's totem was strong, but a cave lion? The thought made her apprehensive. A female with the mightiest of cats for a totem. Now Issa was sure the girl would never mate. It reinforced her decision to teach Ayla healing magic so she would have some status of her own. Kreb had named her, recognized her, and revealed her totem while the medicine woman held her. If that didn't make the girl her daughter, what did? Birth itself was no guarantee of acceptance. Issa suddenly remembered that if everything continued to go well, she would find herself standing in front of the magician again before long, with a baby in her arms. She who had been childless for so long would soon have two. The clan was in an uproar, amazement in their gestures and voices. Self-consciously, Issa returned to her place amid the astonished glances of both women and men. They tried not to stare at her and the girl. It was discourteous to stare, but one man was more than staring. The look of hatred in Braud's eyes as he glowered at the small girl frightened Issa. She tried to place herself between the two, to shield Ayla from the proud young man's malevolent glare. Braud could see he wasn't the center of attention. No one was talking about him anymore. Forgotten was his mighty deed that assured the cave was an acceptable home. Forgotten was his marvelous dance and his stoic courage when Mogur carved his totem mark into his chest. The astringent antiseptic ointment hurt worse than the cut. It still stung. But was anyone noticing how bravely he bore the pain? No one was noticing him at all. The rites of passage for boys becoming men occurred with ordinary regularity, even for those destined to be leader. They didn't compare with the wonder and unexpectedness of Mogur's unprecedented revelation about the strange girl. Braud saw people recalling that she had been led to the cave first. They were saying that the ugly girl found their new home. So what if her totem is the cave lion, Braud thought petulantly. Did she kill the bison? This was supposed to be his night. He was supposed to be the center of attention. He was supposed to be the object of the clan's admiration and awe. But Ayla had stolen his thunder. He glowered at the strange girl, but when he noticed Issa running toward the camp beside the stream, his attention was drawn back to Mogur. Soon, very soon, he would be allowed to participate in the secret rituals with the men. He didn't know what to expect. All he'd ever been told was that he would learn for the first time what memories really were. It was the final step that would make him a man. Beside the fireplace near the stream, Issa quickly removed her wrap and picked up a wooden bowl and red bag of dried roots she had set out. Stopping first to fill the bowl with water, she returned to the huge bonfire, soaring to brighter heights with the additional wood Grodd added. Issa's wrap had covered up part of the reason for her long absences earlier in the day. When the medicine woman stepped in front of the magician again, she was completely naked except for her amulet and the streaks of red painted on her body. A large circle accented the fullness of her stomach. Both breasts were circled too, with a streak drawn from the top of each over her shoulders and joining in a V at the small of her back. Red circles enclosed both cheeks of her buttocks. The enigmatic symbols, whose meaning was known only to Mogur, were for her protection as well as the men's. It was dangerous to have a woman involved in religious rituals, but for this she was necessary. Issa was standing close to Mogur, close enough to see beads of perspiration on his face from standing in front of the hot fire in his heavy bearskin. At an imperceptible signal from him, she held the bowl up and turned to face the clan. It was an ancient bowl, preserved for generations for use only during these special occasions. Some ancestral medicine woman had long and carefully chipped out the center and shaped the outside of a section of the trunk of a tree. Then, even longer, lovingly rubbed the bowl smooth with gritty sand and a round stone. A final smoothing with the abrasive stalks of the scouring rush fern gave it a silky, polished finish. The bowl was coated on the inside with a whitish patina from repeated use as the container for the ceremonial drink. Issa put the dried roots in her mouth and chewed them slowly, careful not to swallow any saliva as her large teeth and strong jaws began to break down the tough fibers. Finally, she spat the masticated pulp into the bowl of water and stirred the fluid until it turned a milky white. Only the medicine women of Issa's line knew the secret of the potent root. The plant was relatively rare, though not unknown, but the fresh root showed little evidence of its narcotic qualities. The root had been dried, aged for at least 2 years, and when hanging to dry, it had been suspended root down rather than top down, as was customary for most herbs. Though only a medicine woman was allowed to make the drink, by long-standing tradition, only men were allowed to drink it. There was an ancient legend passed down from mother to daughter along with the esoteric instructions for concentrating the effective component of the plant into the root that at one time, long ago, only women used the potent drug. The ceremony and rituals associated with its use were stolen by the men, and women were forbidden to use it. But the men could not steal the secret of its preparation. The medicine women who knew it were so reluctant to share the secret with anyone except their own offspring that it had been lost to all but the woman who could claim a direct, unbroken line of descent into the depths of antiquity. Even now, the drink was never given without receiving something of like kind and value in return. When the drink was ready, Issa nodded her head, and Guv stepped forward with a bowl of Datura tea prepared the way he usually did for the men, but this time for the women. With dignified formality, the bowls were exchanged. Then Mogur led the way as the men retreated into the small cave. After they left, Issa took the Datura around to each of the women. The medicine woman often used the same drug as an anesthetic, painkiller, or soporific, and she had a different preparation of the Datura plant ready as a sedative for the children. The women could relax completely only if they knew their youngsters would not come seeking attention, and yet would be safe. On the rare occasions when women allowed themselves the luxury of a ceremony, Issa made sure the children would be safe in the arms of sleep. Before long, the women began putting their drowsy children to bed, then returned to the fire. After tucking Ayla into her fur, Issa went to the overturned bowl Dorv had used during the hunt dance and began beating out a slow, steady rhythm, altering the tone by beating on the top with a stick, then closer to the rim. At first, the women sat unmoving. They were too accustomed to guarding their actions in the presence of men. But gradually, as the effects of the drug began to be felt, and with the knowledge that the men were out of sight, some of the women began to move to the stately rhythm. Abra was the first to jump up. She danced with intricate steps in a circle around Issa, and as the medicine woman increased the tempo, it stirred the senses of more of the women. Soon they all joined the leader's mate. As the rhythm became faster and more complex, the normally docile women threw off their wraps and danced with movements that were unrestrained and, frankly, erotic. They didn't notice when Issa stopped and joined them herself. They were too involved with dancing to their own internal rhythms. Their pent-up emotions, so repressed in everyday life, were released in the uninhibited motion. Tensions drained in a catharsis of freedom, a catharsis that allowed them to accept their restricted existence. In a whirling, jumping, stomping frenzy, the women danced until, near dawn, they dropped, exhausted, and slept where they fell. With the first light of the new day, the men started leaving the cave. Stepping over the bodies of prostrate women, they found their sleeping places and soon drifted into dreamless slumber. The men's catharsis came from the emotional tension of the hunt. Their ceremony had a different dimension, more restrained, turned inward, much older, but no less exciting. As the sun broke over the ridge to the east, Kreb hobbled out of the cave and surveyed the scene littered with bodies. He had, on one rare occasion, watched the women's celebration out of curiosity. With a deep inner sense, the wise old magician understood their need for release. He knew the men always wondered what they did that left them in such a state of exhaustion, but Mogur never enlightened them. The men would have been as shocked by the women's unrestrained abandon as the women would by their stoic mates' fervent supplications to the invisible spirits that shared their existence. Mogur had wondered occasionally if he could direct the minds of women back to the beginnings. Their memories were different, but they had the same ability to recall ancient knowledge. Did they have racial memories? Could they join a ceremony with the men? Mogur wondered, but he would never chance the ire of the spirits by attempting to find out.
It would destroy the clan if a woman were included in such sacred ceremonies. Kreb shuffled to the campsite and eased himself down on his sleeping fur. He saw the disarray of fine blonde hair on Issa's fur, and it set him to thinking about the events that had occurred since he had barely stumbled out in time before the old cave collapsed. How had the strange child charmed her way into his heart so quickly? He was disturbed by the undercurrent of bad feeling from Brunn about her, and he hadn't missed Braud's evil looks in her direction. The dissension in the close-knit group marred the ceremony and left him a bit uneasy. Braud will not let it rest, Kreb thought. The woolly rhinoceros is a suitable totem for our future leader. Braud can be brave, but he's headstrong and too full of pride. One moment he's calm and rational, even gentle and kind, then the next, for some insignificant reason, he can charge with fury in a blind rage. I hope he doesn't turn on the girl. Don't be stupid, he chided himself. The son of Brunn's mate isn't going to let himself get upset over a girl. He's going to be leader, and besides, Brunn would disapprove. Braud is a man now. He will learn to control his temper. The crippled old man lay down and realized how tired he was. Tension had gripped him since the earthquake. But he could relax now. The cave was theirs. Their totems were firmly established in their new home, and the clan could move in when they woke up. The tired magician yawned and stretched out. Then he closed his eye. Chapter 7. A hushed feeling of awe at the cathedral spaciousness of the cave overcame the clan when they first walked into their new quarters, but they soon grew accustomed to it. Thoughts of the old cave and their anxious search receded quickly, and the more they learned about the environment of their new home, the more pleased they became with it. They settled into the usual routine of the short, hot summers, hunting, gathering, and storing food to carry them through the long, freezing cold which they knew from past experience lay ahead. They had a bountiful variety from which to choose. Silver trout flashed through the white spray of the riotous stream, tickled out of the water by hand with infinite patience as the unwary fish rested under overhanging roots and rocks. Giant sturgeon and salmon, often filled with a bonus of fresh black caviar or bright pink roe, hovered near the stream's mouth, while monstrous catfish and black cod swept the bottom of the inland sea. Seine nets, made from the long hair of animals, hand-twisted into cord, strained the large fish from the water as they darted away from waders, herding them toward the barrier of knotted strands. They often hiked the 10 easy miles to the seacoast, and soon had a supply of salty fish dried over smoky fires stored away. Mollusks and crustaceans were collected for ladles, spoons, bowls, and cups, as well as for their succulent morsels. Craggy cliffs were scaled to collect eggs from the multitude of seabirds nesting on the rocky promontories facing the water, and an occasional well-aimed stone brought an added treat of gannet, gull, or great auk. Roots, fleshy stems and leaves, squashes, legumes, berries, fruits, nuts, and grains were each collected in their season as the summer ripened. Leaves and flowers and herbs were dried for teas and flavorings, and sandy chunks of salt left high and dry when the great northern glacier robbed moisture and caused coastlines to recede were carried back to the cave to season winter fare. The hunters went out often. The nearby steppes, rich in grasses and herbs and bereft of all but an occasional stand of stunted trees, abounded in herds of grazing animals. Giant deer ranged the grassy plains, their huge palmate antlers spreading as much as 11 feet in the larger animals, along with oversized bison with horn spreads of similar dimensions. Steppe horses seldom traveled so far south, but asses and onagers, the half-ass intermediate between horses and asses, roamed the open plains of the peninsula, while their massive, robust cousin, the forest horse, lived singly or in small family groups nearer the cave. The steppes also hosted infrequent smaller bands of the lowland-dwelling relative of the goat, the Sega antelope. The parkland between prairie and foothills was home to aurochs, the dark brown or black wild cattle that were the ancestors of gentler domestic breeds. The forest rhinoceros, related to brush-browsing later tropical species, but adapted to cool temperate forests, overlapped only slightly the territory of another variety of rhinos that preferred the grass of the parkland. Both, with their shorter, upright snout horns and horizontal head carriage, differed from the woolly rhino, which, along with the woolly mammoths, were only seasonal visitors. They had a long anterior horn set at a forward-sloping angle and a downward head carriage useful for sweeping snow away from winter pastures.
Their thick layer of subcutaneous fat and their deep red long-haired overcoat and soft woolly undercoat were adaptations that confined them to cold climates. Their natural habitat was the northern freeze-dried steppes, the lowest steppes. Only when glaciers were on the land could there be lowest steppes. The constant low pressure over the vast sheets of ice sucked moisture from the air, allowing little snow to fall in periglacial regions and creating a constant wind. Fine calcareous dust, loess, was picked up from the crushed rock at the edges of the glaciers and deposited for hundreds of miles. A short spring melted the scant snow and the top layer of permafrost, enough for fast-rooting grasses and herbs to sprout. They grew quickly and dried into standing hay, thousands upon thousands of acres of fodder for the millions of animals that had adapted to the freezing cold of the continent. The continental steppes of the peninsula only beckoned the woolly beasts in late fall. The summers were too hot, and the heavy snows of winter were too deep to brush away. Many other animals were driven north in winter to the borders of the colder but drier loess. Most of them migrated back in summer. The forest animals who could browse on brush or bark or lichen stayed on the wooded slopes that offered seclusion and precluded large herds. Besides forest horses and forest rhinos, wild pigs and several varieties of deer found a home in the tree-filled landscape. Red deer, later called elk in other lands, in small herds, individuals and small groups of shy roe deer with simple three-pointed antlers, the slightly larger fawn and white dappled fallow deer, and a few elk, referred to as moose by those who call the red deer elk, all shared the wooded environment. Higher up the mountain, large horned sheep, mouflon, clung to crags and outcrops, feeding on alpine pastures, and higher still, ibex, the wild mountain goat, and chamois gambled from precipice to precipice. Darting swift-winged birds lent color and song to the forest, if not often a meal. Their place on the menu was more easily satisfied by the fat, low-flying ptarmigan and willow grouse of the steppes brought down by swift stones, and the autumn visitations of geese and eider ducks snared by nets as they landed on marshy mountain ponds. Birds of prey and carrion eaters floated lazily on thermal updrafts, scanning the bountiful plains and woodlands below. A host of smaller animals filled the mountains and steppes near the cave, providing food and fur. Hunters, minks, otters, wolverines, ermines, martens, foxes, sables, raccoons, badgers, and the small wildcats that later gave rise to legions of domestic mouse chasers. And hunted, tree squirrels, porcupines, hares, rabbits, moles, muskrats, koipu, beavers, skunks, mice, voles, lemmings, ground squirrels, great jerboas, giant hamsters, pikas, and a few never named and lost to extinction. Larger carnivores were essential to thin the ranks of the abundant prey. There were wolves and their more ferocious relatives, the dog-like dholes. And there were cats, lynxes, cheetahs, tigers, leopards, mountain-dwelling snow leopards, and, twice as large as any, cave lions. Omnivorous brown bears hunted near the cave, but their overgrown cousins, the vegetarian cave bears, were now absent. The ubiquitous cave hyena filled out the complement of wildlife. The land was unbelievably rich, and man only an insignificant fraction of the multifarious life that lived and died in that cold, ancient Eden. Born too raw, without superior natural endowments for it, save one, his oversized brain, he was the weakest of the hunters. But for all his apparent vulnerability, lacking fang or claw or swift leg or leaping strength, the two-legged hunter had gained the respect of his four-legged competitors. His scent alone was enough to veer a far more powerful creature from a chosen path wherever the two lived in close proximity for very long. The capable, experienced hunters of the clan were as skilled in defense as they were in offense, and when the safety or security of the clan was threatened, or if they wanted a warm winter coat decorated by nature, they stalked the unsuspecting stalker. It was a bright, sunlit day, warm with the beginning fullness of summer. The trees were leafed out, but still a shade lighter than they would be later. Lazy flies buzzed around scattered bones from previous meals. A fresh breeze from the sea carried a hint of the life within it, and the moving foliage sent shadows chasing across the sunny slope in front of the cave. With the crisis of finding a new home over, Mogur's duties were light. All that was required of him was an occasional hunting ceremony or ritual to drive away evil spirits, or if someone was hurt or ill, to ask the assistance of beneficent ones to aid Issa's healing magic. The hunters were gone, and several of the women with them. They would not be back for many days. The women went along to preserve the meat after it was killed. Game was easier to bring home, already dried for winter storage. The warm sun and ever-present wind on the steppes quickly desiccated meat cut into thin strips. Smoky fires of dried grass and dung were more for keeping away blowflies that laid eggs in fresh meat, making it rot. The women would also carry most of the load on the way back. Kreb had spent time with Ayla nearly every day since they moved into the cave, trying to teach her their language. The rudimentary words, usually the more difficult part for clan youngsters, she picked up with ease, but their intricate system of gestures and signals was beyond her. He had tried to make her understand the meaning of gestures, but neither had a basis in each other's method of communicating, and there was no one to interpret or explain. The old man had racked his brain, but he had not been able to think of a way to get the meanings across. Ayla was equally frustrated. She knew there was something she was missing, and she ached to be able to communicate beyond the few words she knew. It was obvious to her that the people of the clan understood more than the simple words, but she just didn't know how. The problem was that she didn't see the hand signals. They were random movements to her, not purposeful motions. She simply hadn't been able to grasp the concept of talking with movement. That it was even possible had never occurred to her. It was totally beyond her realm of experience. Kreb had begun to get an inkling of her problem, though he found it hard to believe. It has to be that she doesn't know the motions have meaning, he thought. Ayla, Kreb called, beckoning to the girl. That must be the trouble, he thought, as they walked along a path beside the glinting stream. Either that, or she just isn't intelligent enough to comprehend a language. From his observations, he couldn't believe she lacked intelligence, for all that she was different. But she does understand simple gestures. He had assumed it would only be a matter of enlarging on them. Many feet starting out to hunt, forage, or fish in their direction had already beaten down grass and brush, forming a path along the line of least resistance. They came to a spot the old man favored, an open stretch near a large leafy oak whose high exposed roots offered a shaded, raised seat, easier for him to rest on than lowering himself to the ground. Starting the lesson, he pointed to the tree with his staff. Oak, Ayla quickly responded. Kreb nodded approval, then he aimed his staff at the stream. Water, the girl said. The old man nodded again, then made a motion with his hand and repeated the word. Flowing water, river, the combined gesture and word stated. Water? The girl said hesitantly, puzzled that he had indicated her word was correct, but asked her again. She was getting a feeling of panic deep in her stomach. It was the same as before. She knew there was something more he wanted, but she didn't understand. Kreb shook his head no. He had gone over the same kind of exercises with the child many times. He tried again, pointing to her feet. Feet? Ayla said. Yes, the magician nodded. Somehow I must make her see as well as hear, he thought. Getting up, he took her hand and walked a few steps with her, leaving his staff behind. He made a motion and said the word feet. Moving feet, walking, was the sense he was trying to communicate. She strained to listen, trying to hear if there was something she missed in his tone. Feet? The child said tremulously, sure it was not the answer he wanted. No, no, no. Walking. Feet moving, he repeated again, looking directly at her, exaggerating the gesture. He moved her forward again, pointing at her feet, despairing that she would ever learn. Ayla could feel tears begin to well up in her eyes. Feet. Feet. She knew it was the right word. Why did he shake his head no? She'd stop moving his hand around in front of my face like that. What am I doing wrong? The old man walked her forward again, pointed at her feet, made the motion with his hand, said the word. She stopped and watched him. He made the gesture again, exaggerating it so much it almost meant something else, said the word again. He was bent over, looking her squarely in the face, making the motion directly in front of her eyes. Gesture, word. Gesture, word. What does he want? What am I supposed to do? She wanted to understand him. She knew he was trying to tell her something. Why does he keep moving his hand, she thought. Then the barest glimmer of an idea came to her. His hand. He keeps moving his hand. She lifted her hand hesitantly. Yes, yes, that's it,
Krebs, vigorous affirmative nodding, almost shouted. "Make the signal! Moving! Moving feet!" he repeated. With dawning comprehension, she watched his motion, then tried to copy it.